Chapter 2 Palaces.
When Alder came down to the docks, Farflyer was still there, taking on a cargo of timbers. But he knew he had worn out his welcome on that ship. He went to a small, shabby coaster tied up next to her, the Pretty Rose. Sparrowhawk had given him a letter of passage signed by the king and sealed with the rune of peace. "He sent it from me to you, if I changed my mind," the old man had said with a snort. "It'll serve you." The ship's master, after getting his purser to read it for him, became quite deferential and apologized for the cramped quarters and the length of the voyage. Pretty Rose was going to Havnor, sure enough, but she was a coaster, trading small goods from port to port, and it might take her a month to work clear around the southeast coast of the great island to the king's city. That was all right with him, Alder said, for if he dreaded the voyage, he feared its ending more. New moon to half moon, the sea voyage was a time of peace for him. The gray kitten was a hardy traveler, busy mousing the ship all day, but faithfully curling up under his chin or within hand's reach at night. And to his unceasing wonder, that little scrap of warm life kept him from the wall of stones and the voices calling him across it. Not wholly, not so that he ever entirely forgot them. They were there, just through the veil of sleep in darkness, just through the brightness of the day. Sleeping out on deck those warm nights, he opened his eyes often to see that the stars moved, swinging to the rocking of the moored ship, following their courses through heaven to the west. He was still a haunted man, but for a half month of summer along the coasts of Kemmerber and Barnisk and the great island, he could turn his back on his ghosts. For days the kitten hunted a young rat nearly as big as it was. Seeing it proudly and laboriously hauling the carcass across the deck, one of the sailors called it Tug. Alder accepted the name for it. They sailed down the Abavnor Straits and in through the portals of Havnor Bay. Across the sunlit water, little by little, the white towers of the city at the center of the world resolved out of the haze of distance. Alder stood at the prow as they came in and, looking up, saw on the pinnacle of the highest tower a flash of silver light, the sword of Aerith Akby. Now he wished he could stay aboard and sail on and not go ashore into the great city among great people with a letter for the king. He knew he was no fit messenger. Why had such a burden been laid on him? How could it be that a village sorcerer who knew nothing of high matters and deep arts was called on to make these journeys from land to land, from mage to monarch, from the living to the dead? He had said something like that to Sparrowhawk. "It's all beyond me," he had said. The old man looked at him a while, and then, calling him by his true name, said, "The world's vast and strange, Hara, but no vaster and no stranger than our minds are. Think of that sometimes." Behind the city the sky darkened with a thunderstorm inland. The towers burned white against purple-black, and gulls soared like drifting sparks of fire above them. Pretty Rose was moored, the gangplank run out. This time the sailors wished him well as he shouldered his pack. He picked up the covered poultry basket in which Tug crouched patiently and went ashore. The streets were many and crowded, but the way to the palace was plain, and he had no idea what to do except go there and say that he carried a letter for the king from the Archmage Sparrowhawk. And that he did, many times. From guard to guard, from official to official, from the broad outer steps of the palace to high anterooms, staircases with gilded banisters, inner offices with tapestried walls, across floors of tile and marble and oak, under ceilings coffered, beamed, vaulted, painted, he went repeating his talisman. "I come from Sparrowhawk, who was the Archmage, with a letter for the king. He would not give his letter up. A retinue, a crowd of suspicious, semi-civil, patronizing, temporizing, obstructive guards and ushers and officials kept gathering and thickening around him and followed him and impeded his slow way into the palace. Suddenly, they were all gone. A door had opened. It closed behind him. He stood alone in a quiet room. A wide window looked out over the roofs northwestward. The thundercloud had cleared, and the broad gray summit of Mount On hovered above far hills. Another door opened. A man came in, dressed in black, about Alder's age, quick-moving, with a fine, strong face as smooth as bronze. He came straight to Alder.
Master Alder, I am Labannon.
He put out his right hand to touch Alder's hand, palm against palm, as the custom was in Ea and the Enlades. Alder responded automatically to the familiar gesture. Then he thought he ought to kneel, or bow, at least, but the moment to do so seemed to have passed. He stood dumb. You came from my lord Sparrowhawk. How is he? Is he well? Yes, lord. He sends you... Alder hurriedly groped inside his jacket for the letter which he had intended to offer to the king kneeling, when they finally showed him to the throne room where the king would be sitting on his throne. This letter, my lord. The eyes watching him were alert, urbane, as implacably keen as Sparrowhawk's, but withholding even more of the mind within. As the king took the letter Alder offered him, his courtesy was perfect. The bearer of any word from him has my heart's thanks and welcome. Will you forgive me? Alder finally managed to bow. The king walked over to the window and read the letter. He read it twice at least, then refolded it. His face was as impassive as before. He went to the door and spoke to someone outside it, then turned back to Alder. Please, he said, sit down with me. They'll bring us something to eat. You've been all afternoon in the palace, I know. If the gate captain had had the wits to send me word, I could have spared you hours of climbing the walls and swimming the moats they set around me. Did you stay with my lord Sparrowhawk? In his house, on the cliff's edge? Yes. I envy you. I've never been there. I haven't seen him since we parted on Roke, half my lifetime ago. He wouldn't let me come to him on Gaunt. He wouldn't come to my crowning. Labannon smiled, as if nothing he said was of any moment. He gave me my kingdom, he said. Sitting down, he nodded to Alder to take the chair facing him across a little table. Alder looked at the tabletop, inlaid with curling patterns of ivory and silver, leaves and blossoms of the rowan tree twined about slender swords. Did you have a good voyage? The king asked, and made other small talk while they were served plates of cold meat and smoked trout and lettuces and cheese. He set Alder a welcome example by eating with a good appetite, and he poured them wine, the palest topaz, in goblets of crystal. He raised his glass. To my lord and dear friend, he said. Alder murmured to him and drank. The king spoke about town, which he had visited a few years before. Alder remembered the excitement of the island when the king was in Meoni, and he spoke of some musicians from town who were in the city now, harpers and singers come to make music for the court. It might be Alder knew some of them, and indeed the names he said were familiar. He was very skilled at putting his guest at ease, and food and wine were a considerable help, too. When they were done eating, the king poured them another half glass of wine and said, "The letter concerns you, mostly. Did you know that?" His tone had not changed much from the small talk, and Alder was fuddled for a moment. "No," he said. Do you have an idea what it deals with?
What I dream, maybe, Alder said, speaking low, looking down.
The king studied him for a moment. There was nothing offensive in his gaze, but he was more open in that scrutiny than most men would have been. Then he took up the letter and held it out to Alder.
My lord, I read very little.
Labanon was not surprised. Some sorcerers could read, some could not. But he clearly and sharply regretted putting his guest at a disadvantage. The gold-bronze skin of his face went dusky red. He said,
I'm sorry, Alder. May I read you what he says?
Please, my lord, Alder said. The king's embarrassment made him, for a moment, feel the king's equal, and he spoke for the first time naturally and with warmth. Labanon scanned the salutation and some lines of the letter, and then read aloud. Alder of Town, who bears this to you, is one called in dream, and not by his own will, to that land you and I crossed once together. He will tell you of suffering where suffering is past, and change where no thing changes. We closed the door, Cobb opened. Now the wall itself, maybe, is to fall. He has been to Roke. Only Asver heard him. My lord the king will hear and will act as wisdom instructs and need requires. Alder bears my lifelong honor and obedience to my lord the king. Also my lifelong honor and regard to my lady Tenar. Also to my beloved daughter Tehanu, a spoken message from me. And he signs it with the rune of the Talon. Labanon looked up from the letter into Alder's eyes and held his gaze. Tell me what it is you dream, he said. So once more, Alder told his story. He told it briefly and not very well. Though he had been in awe of Sparrowhawk, the ex-archmage looked and dressed and lived like an old villager or farmer. A man of Alder's own kind and standing, and that simplicity had defeated all superficial timidity. But however kind and courteous the king might be, he looked like the king, he behaved like the king. He was the king, and to Alder the distance was insuperable. He hurried through as best he could and stopped with relief. Labanon asked a few questions. Lily and then Gannett had each touched Alder once. Never since? And Gannett's touch had burned? Alder held out his hand. The marks were almost invisible under a month's tan. I think the people at the wall would touch me if I came close to them, he said.
But you keep away from them.
I have done so.
And they are not people you knew in life?
Sometimes I think I know one or another,
but never your wife.
There are so many of them, my lord. Sometimes I think she's there, but I can't see her.
To talk about it brought it near, too near. He felt the fear welling up in him again. He thought the walls of the room might melt away, and the evening sky and the floating mountain crown vanish like a curtain brushed aside, to leave him standing where he was always standing, on a dark hill by a wall of stones. Alder. He looked up, shaken, his head swimming. The room seemed bright, the king's face hard and vivid.
You'll stay here in the palace? It was an invitation, but Alder could only nod, accepting it as an order.
Good.
I'll arrange for you to give the message you bear to Mistress Tehanu tomorrow. And I know the White Lady will wish to talk with you.
He bowed. Labanon turned away.
My lord.
Labanon turned.
May I have my cat with me?
Not a flicker of a smile, no mockery.
Of course.
My lord, I am sorry to my heart to bring news that troubles you.
Any word from the man who sent you is a grace to me and to its bearer, and I'd rather get bad news from an honest man than lies from a flatterer, Labanon said, and Alder, hearing the true accent of his home islands in the words, was a little cheered. The king went out, and at once a man looked in the door Alder had entered by.
I will take you to your chamber if you will follow me, sir, he said. He was dignified, elderly, and well-dressed, and Alder followed him without any idea whether he was a nobleman or a servant, and therefore not daring to ask him about Tug. In the room before the room where he had met the king, the officials and guards and ushers had absolutely insisted that he leave his poultry basket with them. It had been eyed with suspicion and inspected with disapproval by 10 or 15 officials already. He had explained 10 or 15 times that he had the cat with him because he had nowhere in the city to leave it. The anteroom where he had been compelled to set it down was far behind him. He had not seen it there as they went through. He would never find it now. It was half a palace away, corridors, hallways, passages, doors. His guide bowed and left him in a small, beautiful room, tapestried, carpeted, a chair with an embroidered seat, a window that looked out to the harbor, a table on which stood a bowl of summer fruit and a pitcher of water, and the poultry basket. He opened it. Tug emerged in a leisurely manner, indicating his familiarity with palaces. He stretched, sniffed Alder's fingers in greeting, and went about the room examining things. He discovered a curtained alcove with a bed in it and jumped up on the bed. A discreet knock at the door. A young man entered carrying a large, flat, heavy wooden box with no lid. He bowed to Alder, murmuring, "Sand, sir." He placed the box in the far corner of the alcove. He bowed again and left. "Well," Alder said, sitting down on the bed. He was not in the habit of talking to the kitten. Their relationship was one of silent, trustful touch. But he had to talk to somebody. "I met the king today," he said.
The king had all too many people to talk to before he could sit down on his bed. Chief among them were the emissaries of the High King of the Kargs. They were about to take their leave, having accomplished their mission to Hafnor, to their own satisfaction, if not at all to Labanon's. He had looked forward to the visit of these ambassadors as the culmination of years of patient overture, invitation, and negotiation. For the first 10 years of his reign, he had been able to accomplish nothing at all with the Kargs. The God King in Awabath rejected his offers of treaties and trade, and sent his envoys back unheard, declaring that gods do not parley with vile mortals, least of all with accursed sorcerers. But the God-King's proclamations of universal divine empire were not followed by the threatened fleets of a myriad ships bearing plumed warriors to overrun the godless West. Even the pirate raids that had plagued the eastern isles of the archipelago for so long gradually ceased. The pirates had become contrabanders, seeking to trade whatever unlicensed goods they could smuggle out of Karego At for archipelagan iron, steel, and bronze, for the Kargad lands were poor in mines and metal. It was from these illicit traders that news first came of the rise of the High King. On Hur-At-Hur, the big poor easternmost island of the Kargad lands, a warlord Thal, claiming descent from Thorig of Hupun and from the god Wulua, had made himself High King of that land. Next he had conquered At-Nini, and then, with a fleet and an invading army drawn from both Hur-At-Hur and At-Nini, he had claimed dominion over the rich central island, Karego At. While his warriors were fighting their way toward Awabath, the capital city, the people of the city rose up against the tyranny of the God-King. They slaughtered the high priests, drove the bureaucrats out of the temples, threw the gates wide, and welcomed King Thal to the throne of Thorig with banners and dancing in the streets. The God-King fled with a remnant of his guards and hierophants to the place of the tombs on Atuan. There in the desert, in his temple by the earthquake-shattered ruins of the Shrine of the Nameless Ones, one of his priest eunuchs cut the god-king's throat. Thal proclaimed himself High King of the Four Kagard Lands. As soon as he got word of that, Labanon sent ambassadors to greet his brother king and assure him of the friendly disposition of the archipelago. 5 years of difficult and tiresome diplomacy had ensued. Thal was a violent man on a threatened throne. In the wreckage of the theocracy, all control in his realm was chancy, all authority questionable. Lesser kings constantly declared themselves and had to be bought or beaten into obedience to the High King. Sectarians issued from shrines and caverns crying, "Woe to the mighty!" and foretelling earthquake, tidal wave, plague upon the deicides. Ruling a troubled, divided empire, Thal could scarcely place any trust in the powerful and wealthy archipelagans. It meant nothing to him that their king talked about friendship, flourishing the Ring of Peace. Did not the Kargs have a claim to that ring? It had been made in ancient days in the West, but long ago King Thoreg of Ahupun had accepted it as a gift from the hero Aerith Akbi, a sign of amity between the Kargad and Hardik lands. It had disappeared, and there had been war, not amity. But then the Hawk Mage had found the ring and stolen it back, along with the priestess of the tombs of Atuan, and carried both off to Havnor. So much for the trustworthiness of the archipelagans. Through his envoys, Labanon patiently and politely pointed out that the Ring of Peace had, to begin with, been Morid's gift to Elfarin, a cherished token of the archipelago's most beloved king and queen, and a very sacred thing as well, for on it was the Bond Rune, a mighty enchantment of blessing. Nearly 4 centuries ago, Aerith Akbi had taken it to the Kargad lands as a pledge of unbreakable peace. But the priests of Awabath had broken the pledge and broken the ring. Some 40 years ago now, Sparrowhawk of Roke and Tenar of Atuan had healed the ring. What then of the peace? That had been the gist of his messages to King Thal. And a month ago, just after the long dance of summer, a fleet of ships had come sailing straight down the passage of Felkwe, up the Abavnor Straits, and in between the portals of Havnor Bay. Long red ships with red sails, carrying plumed warriors, gorgeous robed emissaries, and a few veiled women. Let the daughter of Thal the High King, who sits upon the throne of Thoreg, whose ancestor was Wulua, wear the Ring of Peace upon her arm, as Queen Alfarin of Solea wore it, and this will be the sign of everlasting peace between the Western and Eastern Isles. That was the High King's message to Labanon. It was written out in big Hardik runes on a scroll. But before handing it to King Labanon, Thal's ambassador read it out loud in public, at the reception of the emissaries at the court in Havnor, and with the whole court there to do the Kargish envoy's honor. Perhaps it was because the ambassador did not actually read Hardik, but spoke the words loudly and slowly from memory, that they had the tone of an ultimatum. The princess said nothing. She stood among the 10 handmaidens or slave girls who had accompanied her to Havnor, and the flock of court ladies who had been hastily assigned to look after her and do her honor. She was veiled, entirely veiled, as was, it appeared, the custom of well-born women in Hur At-Hur. The veils, red with lines of gold embroidery, fell straight down from a flat-brimmed hat or headdress, so that the princess appeared to be a red column or pillar, cylindrical, featureless, motionless, silent. "The High King Thal does us great honor," Labanon said in his clear, quiet voice, and then he paused. The court and the emissaries waited. "You are welcome here, princess," he said to the veiled figure. It did not stir. "Let the princess be lodged in the river house, and let all be as she desires," Labanon said. The river house was a beautiful, small palace at the northern edge of the city, fitted into the old city wall, with terraces built out over the little river Saranen. Queen Haru had built it, and it was often called the Queen's House. When Labanon came to the throne, he had it repaired and refurnished, along with the palace of Meharian, called the New Palace, in which he held court. He used the river house only for summer festivities and sometimes as a retreat for himself for a few days. A little rustle now went through his courtiers. The Queen's house?
After urbanities among the Kargish emissaries, Labanon left the audience room. He went to his dressing room, where he could be as alone as a king can be, with his old servant Oak, whom he had known all his life. He slapped the gilded scroll down on a table. "She's in a rat trap," he said. He was shaking. He whipped the dagger he always wore out of its sheath and stabbed it straight down through the High King's message. "A pig in a poke," he said. "A piece of goods. The ring on her arm and the collar around my neck." Oak stared at him in blank dismay. Prince Aaron of Inlad had never lost his temper. When he was a child, he might have wept for a moment, one bitter sob, but that was all. He was too well trained, too well disciplined to give way to anger. And as king, a king who had earned his realm by crossing the land of the dead, he could be stern, but always, Oak thought, too proud, too strong for anger. "They will not use me," Labanon said, stabbing the dagger down again, his face so black and blind with fury that the old man drew back from him in real fear. Labanon saw him. He always saw the people around him. He sheathed his dagger. He said in a steadier voice, "Oak, by my name, I will destroy Thal and his kingdom before I let him use me as a footstool to his throne." And then he drew a long breath and sat down to let Oak lift the heavy gold-weighted state robe from his shoulders. Oak never breathed a word of the scene to anyone. But there was, of course, immediate and continuous speculation about the princess of the Kargs and what the king was going to do about her, or what, in fact, he had already done. He had not said that he accepted the offer of the princess as his bride, for all agreed she had been offered to him as his bride. The language about Ulfaran's ring barely veiled the offer, or the bargain, or the threat. But he had not refused it either. His response, endlessly analyzed, had been to say she was welcome, that all should be as she desired, and that she should live in the river house, the queen's house. Surely that was significant. But, on the other hand, why not in the new palace? Why send her across the city? Ever since Labanon's coronation, ladies of noble houses and princesses of the old royal lineages of Inlad, Ea, and Sheliath had come to visit or to stay at the court. They had all been entertained most royally, and the king had danced at their weddings as one by one they settled for noblemen or wealthy commoners. It was well known that he liked the company of women and their council as well, that he would willingly flirt with a pretty girl and invite an intelligent woman to advise him, tease him, or console him. But no girl or woman had ever come near the rumor of a shadow of a chance of marrying him, and none had ever been lodged in the river house. The king must have a queen, his advisers told him at regular intervals. "You really must marry Arryn," his mother had told him the last time he saw her alive. "The heir of Morrigh, will he have no heir?" asked the common people. To all of them, he had said in various words and ways, "Give me time. I have the ruins of a kingdom to rebuild. Let me make a house worthy of a queen, a realm my child can rule." And because he was well-loved and trusted, and still a young man, and for all his gravity a charming and persuasive one, he had escaped all the hopeful maidens. Until now. What was under the stiff red veils? Who lived inside that unrevealing tent? The ladies assigned to the princess's entourage were besieged by questions. Was she pretty? Ugly? Was it true she was tall and thin, short and muscular, white as milk, pockmarked, one-eyed, yellow-haired, black-haired, 45 years old, 10 years old, a drooling cretin, a brilliant beauty? Gradually the rumors began to run one way. She was young, though not a child, hair neither yellow nor black, pretty enough, said some of the ladies, coarse, said others, spoke not a word of heartache, they all said, and would not learn. Hid among her women, and when forced to leave her room, hid in her red tent veils. The king had paid her a visit of courtesy. She had not bowed to him, or spoken, or made any sign, but stood there, said old Lady Ayessa in exasperation, like a brick chimney. He spoke to her through men who had served as his envoys in the Kargat lands, and through the Karg ambassador, who spoke fairly good-hearted. Laboriously he transmitted his compliments and queries as to her wishes and desires. The translator spoke to her women, whose veils were shorter and somewhat less impenetrable. Her women gathered round the motionless red pillar and mumbled and buzzed and returned to the translators, and the translators informed the king that the princess was content and required nothing. She had been there half a month when Tanar and Tahanu arrived from Gaunt. Labanan had sent a ship and a message begging them to come shortly before the Kargad fleet brought the princess, and for reasons that had nothing to do with her or King Thal. But the first time he was alone with Tanar, he burst out, "What am I going to do with her? What can I do?" "Tell me about it," Tanar said, looking somewhat amazed. Labanan had spent only a brief time with Tanar, though they had written a few letters over the years. He was not yet used to her hair being gray, and she seemed smaller than he remembered her. But with her he felt immediately, as he had 15 years earlier, that he could say anything and she would understand. "For 5 years, I've built up trade and tried to keep on good terms with Thal, because he's a warlord and I don't want my kingdom pinched, as it was in Meharian's reign, between dragons in the west and warlords in the east. And because I rule in the sign of peace. And it went well enough till this. Till he sends this girl out of the blue, saying, 'If you want peace, give her Eltharin's ring. Your ring, Tanar. Yours and Ged's.'" Tanar hesitated a while. "She is his daughter, after all. What's a daughter to a barbarian king? Goods. A bargaining piece to buy advantage with, you know that. You were born there." It was unlike him to speak so, and he heard it himself. He knelt down suddenly, catching her hand and putting it over his eyes in a sign of contrition. "Tanar, I'm sorry. This disturbs me beyond all reason. I can't see what to do." "Well, as long as you do nothing, you have some leeway. Maybe the princess has some opinion of her own. How can she? Hidden in that red sack. She won't talk, she won't look out, she might as well be a tent pole." He tried to laugh. His own uncontrollable resentment alarmed him, and he tried to excuse it. "This came on just as I had troubling news from the west. It was for that that I asked you and Tahanu to come, not to bother you with this foolishness." "It isn't foolishness," Tanar said. But he brushed the topic away, dismissed it, and began to talk about dragons. Since the news from the west had been troubling indeed, he had succeeded in not thinking about the princess at all, most of the time. He was aware that it was not his habit to handle matters of state by ignoring them. Manipulated, one manipulates others. Several days after their conversation, he asked Tanar to visit the princess, to try to get her to talk. After all, he said, they spoke the same language. "Probably," Tanar said, "I never knew anybody from Hur at Hur. On Atuan, we call them barbarians." He was chastised. But, of course, she did what he asked. Presently, she reported that she and the princess spoke the same language, or nearly the same, and that the princess had not known that there were any other languages. She had thought all the people here, the courtiers and ladies, were malicious lunatics, mocking her by chattering and yapping like animals without human speech. As well as Tanar could tell, she had grown up in the desert, in King Thal's original domain on Hur at Hur, and had only been very briefly at the imperial court in Awabath before she was sent on to Havnor. "She's frightened," Tanar said, "so she hides in her tent. What does she think I am? How could she know what you are?" He scowled. "How old is she?" "Young, but a woman." "I can't marry her," he said with sudden resolution. "I'll send her back." "A returned bride is a dishonored woman. If you send her back, Thal might kill her to keep the dishonor from his house. He'll certainly consider that you intend to dishonor him." The look of fury came into his face again. Tanar forestalled him. "Barbarian customs," he said stiffly. He strode up and down the room. "Very well. But I will not consider this girl as queen of the kingdom of Morad. Can she be taught to speak Hardic? A few words, at least? Is she unteachable? I'll tell Thal that a Hardic king can't marry a woman who doesn't speak the language of the realm. I don't care if he doesn't like it. He needs the slap, and it buys me time." "And you'll ask her to learn Hardic? How can I ask her anything if she takes it all for gibberish? What possible use is there in my going to her?" "I thought perhaps," you'd speak to her, Tanar. You must see what an imposition this is. Using this girl to make Thal appear my equal. Using the ring you brought us, as a trap. I cannot even seem to condone it. I'm willing to temporize, to delay, in order to keep the peace, nothing more. Even that much deceit is vile. Tell the girl what you think best. I will have nothing to do with her. And he went out in a righteous wrath, which cooled slowly into an uneasy feeling much resembling shame. When the Kargish emissaries announced they would be leaving soon, Labanon prepared a carefully worded message for King Thal. He expressed his appreciation of the honor of the princess's presence in Hafnor, and the pleasure he and his court would have in introducing her to the manners, customs, and language of his kingdom. He said nothing at all about the ring, about marrying her, or about not marrying her. It was in the evening after his conversation with the dream-troubled sorcerer from Talon that he met for the last time with the Kargs and gave them his letter to the High King. He read it aloud first, as the ambassador had read aloud Thal's letter to him. The ambassador listened complacently. "The High King will be pleased," he said. All the time he was talking amenities to the emissaries and displaying the gifts he was sending to Thal, Labanon puzzled over this easy acceptance of his evasiveness. His thoughts all came to one conclusion. He knows I'm stuck with her. To which his mind made a passionate, silent answer. Never. He inquired whether the ambassador would be going by the river house to bid his princess farewell. The ambassador looked at him blankly as if he had been asked if he was going to say goodbye to a package he had delivered. Labanon felt the anger rising in his heart again. He saw the ambassador's face change a little, taking on a wary, placating look. He smiled and wished the emissaries a fair wind to the Kargad lands. He went out of the audience chamber into his own room. Rites and ceremony hedged most of his acts, and as king he must be in public most of his life. But because he had come to a throne empty for centuries, a palace where there were no protocols, he had been able to have some things as he liked them. He had kept ceremony out of his bedroom. His nights were his own. He said goodnight to Oak, who would sleep in the anteroom, and shut the door. He sat down on his bed. He felt tired and angry and strangely desolate. Around his neck he always wore a slight gold chain with a little pouch of cloth of gold on it. In the pouch was a pebble, a dull black bit of rock, rough-edged. He took it out and held it in his hand as he sat and thought. He tried to turn his mind away from all this stupidity about the Kargish girl by thinking about the sorcerer Alder and his dreams. But all that came into his mind was a painful envy of Alder for having gone ashore on Gaunt, having talked with Ged, having stayed with him. That was why he felt desolate. The man he called his lord, the man he had loved above all others, wouldn't let him come near, wouldn't come to him. Did Ged believe that because he had lost his wizardly power, Labanon must think less of him, must despise him? Given the power that power had over the minds and hearts of men, it was not an implausible thought. But surely Ged knew him better, or at least thought better of him. Was it that, having been truly Labanon's lord and guide, Ged could not bear to be his subject? That might indeed be hard for the old man to bear. The blunt, irrevocable reversal of their status. But Labanon remembered very clearly how Ged had knelt to him, down on both knees, on Rok Nol, in the shadow of the dragon, and in the sight of the masters whose master Ged had been. He had stood up and kissed Labanon, telling him to rule well, calling him my lord and dear companion. He gave me my kingdom, Labanon had said to Alder. That had been the moment he gave it. Holy, freely. And that was why Ged wouldn't come to Hafnor, wouldn't let Labanon come to take counsel with him. He had handed over the power, holy, freely. He would not even seem to meddle, to cast his shadow across Labanon's light. He has done with doing, the doorkeeper had said. But Alder's story had moved Ged to send the man here, to Labanon, asking him to act as need required. It was indeed strange, Alder's story, and Ged saying that maybe the wall itself was going to fall was stranger yet. What could it mean? And why should one man's dreams bear so much weight? He himself had dreamed of the outskirts of the dry land long ago, when he and Ged the Archmage were traveling together, before they ever came to Salador. And on that westernmost of all the islands, he had followed Ged into the dry land, across the wall of stones, down to dim cities where the shadows of the dead stood in doorways, or walked without aim or purpose in streets lit only by the moveless stars. With Ged he had walked across all that country, a weary way to a dark valley of dust and stones at the foot of the mountains whose only name was Pain. He opened his palm, looked down at the little black stone he held, closed his hand on it again. From the valley of the dry river, having done what they came to do, and they had climbed up into the mountains because there was no turning back. They had gone up the road forbidden to the dead, climbing, clamoring over rocks that scored and burned their hands, till Ged could go no farther. Labanon had carried him as far as he could, then crawled on with him to the end of darkness, the hopeless cliff of night, and so had come back with him into the sunlight and the sound of the sea breaking on the shores of life. It was a long time since he had thought so vividly of that terrible journey. But the bit of black stone from those mountains was always over his heart. And it seemed to him now that the memory of that land, the darkness of it, the dust, was always in his mind, just under the bright, various play and movement of the days, although he always looked away from it. He looked away because he could not bear the knowledge that in the end that was where he would come again, come alone, uncompanioned, and forever, to stand empty-eyed, unspeaking, in the shadows of a shadow city, never to see sunlight or drink water or touch a living hand. He got up abruptly, shaking off these morbid thoughts. He closed the stone in its pouch, made ready for bed, put out the lamp, and lay down. At once he saw it again. The dim, gray land of dust and rock. It rose up far ahead into black, sharp peaks, but here it sloped away, always downward, to the right, into utter darkness. What lies that way? He had asked Ged as they walked on and on. His companion had said he did not know, that maybe that way there was no end. Labanon sat up, angered and alarmed by the relentless drift of his thought. His eyes sought the window. It looked north. He liked the view from Havnor across the hills to the tall, gray-headed mountain On. Farther north, unseen, across all the width of the great island and the Sea of Ea, was Inlad, his home. Lying in bed, he could only see the sky a clear summer night, the heart of the swan riding high among the lesser stars. His kingdom. The kingdom of light, of life. Where the stars blossomed like white flowers in the east and drooped in their brightness to the west. He would not think of that other realm where the stars stayed still, where there was no power in a man's hand, and no right way to go because no way led anywhere. Lying gazing at the stars, he turned his mind deliberately from those memories and from the thought of Ged. He thought of Tanar, the sound of her voice, the touch of her hand. Courtiers were ceremonious, cautious about how and when they touched the king. She was not. She laid her hand on his, laughing. She was bolder with him than his mother had been. Rose, princess of the House of Enlad, had died of a fever 2 years ago, while he was on shipboard, coming to make a royal visit to Barilla on Inlad and the isles south of it. He had not known of her death till he came home to a city and a house in mourning. His mother was there now in the dark country, the dry country. If he came there and passed her on the street, she would not look at him. She would not speak to him. He clenched his hands. He rearranged the cushions of his bed, trying to make himself easy, trying to set his mind away from there, to think of things that would keep him from going back there to think of his mother living, her voice, her dark eyes under the dark arched brows, her delicate hands. Or to think of Tanar. He knew he had asked Tanar to come to Havnor not only to take counsel from her, but because she was the mother that remained to him. He wanted that love, to give it and be given it. The ruthless love that makes no allowances, no conditions. Tanar's eyes were gray, not dark, but she looked right through him with a piercing tenderness, undeceived by anything he said or did. He knew he did well what he had been called to do. He knew he was good at playing king, but only with his mother and with Tanar had he ever known beyond any self-doubt what it was to be king.
Tanar had known him since he was a very young man, not yet crowned. She had loved him then and ever since, for his sake, for Ged's sake, and for her own. He was to her the son who never breaks your heart. But she thought he might yet manage to, if he kept on being so rageful and dishonest about this poor girl from Hur At-Hur. She attended the final audience of the emissaries from Awabath. Labanad had asked her to be there, and she was glad to come. Finding Kargs at the court when she came there at the beginning of summer, she had expected them to shun her, or at least to eye her askance. The renegade priestess who, with the thieving hawk mage, had stolen the ring of Aerith Akbi from the treasury of the tombs of Atuan, and traitorously fled with it to Havnor. It was her doing that the archipelago had a king again. The Kargs might well hold it against her. And Thole of Hur At-Hur had restored the worship of the twin gods and the nameless ones, whose greatest temple Tanar had despoiled. Her treason had been not only political, but religious. Yet that was long ago, 40 years and more, almost the stuff of legend, and statesmen remember things selectively. Thole's ambassador had begged the honor of an audience with her and had greeted her with elaborately pious respect, some of which she thought was real. He called her Lady Arha, the Eaten One, the one ever reborn. She had not been called by those names for years, and they sounded very strange to her. But it gave her a keen, rueful pleasure to hear her native tongue and to find she could still speak it. So she came to bid the ambassador and his company goodbye. She asked him to assure the High King of the Kargs that his daughter was well, and she looked admiringly a last time at the tall, raw-boned men with their pale, braided hair, their plumed headdresses, their court armor of silver mesh interwoven with feathers. When she lived in the Kargad land, she had seen few men of her own race. Only women and eunuchs had lived at the place of the tombs. After the ceremony, she escaped into the gardens of the palace. The summer night was warm and restless, flowering shrubs of the gardens stirring in the night wind. The sounds of the city outside the palace walls were like the murmur of a quiet sea. A couple of young courtiers were walking entwined under the arbors. Not to disturb them, Tanar walked among the fountains and the roses at the other end of the garden. Labanan had left the audience scowling again. What was wrong with him? So far as she knew, he had never before rebelled against the obligations of his position. Certainly he knew that a king must marry and has little real choice as to whom he marries. He knew that a king who does not obey his people is a tyrant. He knew his people wanted a queen, wanted heirs to the throne. But he had done nothing about it. Women of the court had been happy to gossip to Tanar about his several mistresses, none of whom had lost anything by being known as the king's lover. He had certainly managed all that quite well, but he couldn't expect to do so forever. Why was he so enraged by King Thole's offering him a perfectly appropriate solution? Imperfectly appropriate, perhaps. The princess was something of a problem. Tanar was going to have to try to teach the girl Hardik, and to find ladies willing to instruct her in the manners of the archipelago and the etiquette of the court, something she certainly wasn't capable of herself. She had more sympathy with the princess's ignorance than with the courtier's sophistication. She resented Labanan's failure or inability to take the girl's point of view. Couldn't he imagine what it was like for her? Brought up in the women's quarters of a warlord's fortress in a remote desert land, where she probably had never seen any man but her father and uncles and some priests, suddenly carried off from that changeless poverty and rigidity of life by strangers, on a long and frightening sea voyage, abandoned among people whom she knew of only as irreligious and bloodthirsty monsters who dwelt on the far edge of the world, not truly human at all, because they were wizards who could turn into animals and birds. And she was to marry one of them. Tanar had been able to leave her own people and come to live among the monsters and wizards of the West because she had been with Ged, whom she loved and trusted. Even so, it had not been easy. Often her courage had failed. For all the welcome the people of Havnor had given her, the crowds and cheering and flowers and praise, the sweet names they called her, the White Lady, the Peacebringer, Tanar of the Ring. For all that, she had cowered in her room in the palace those nights long ago, in misery because she was so lonely, and nobody spoke her language, and she didn't know any of the things they all knew. As soon as the rejoicings were over and the ring was in its place, she had begged Ged to take her away, and he had kept his promise, slipping away with her to Gaunt. There she had lived in the old mage's house as Ogion's ward and pupil, learning how to be an archipelagon, till she saw the way she wanted to follow for herself as a woman grown. She had been younger than this girl when she came to Havnor with the ring, but she had not grown up powerless as the princess had, though her power as the one priestess had been mostly ceremonial, nominal. She had taken real control of her fate when she broke with the grim ways of her upbringing and won freedom for her prisoner and herself. But the daughter of a warlord would have control over only trivial things. When her father made himself king, she would be called princess. She would be given richer clothing, more slaves, more eunuchs, more jewelry, until she herself was given in marriage. But she would have no say in any of it. All she ever saw of the world outside the women's quarters would be through window slits in thick walls, through layers of red veiling. Tanar counted herself lucky not to have been born on so backward and barbaric an island as Hur Atur, never to have worn the Feag. But she knew what it was to grow up in the grip of an iron tradition. It behooved her to do what she could to help the princess, so long as she was in Havnor, but she didn't intend to stay here long. Strolling in the garden, watching the fountains glimmer in starlight, she thought about how and when she could go home. She did not mind the formalities of court life, or the knowledge that under the civility simmered a stew of ambitions, rivalries, passions, complicities, collusions. She had grown up with rituals and hypocrisy and hidden politics, and none of it frightened or worried her. She was simply homesick. She wanted to be back on Gaunt with Ged in their house. She had come to Havnor because Labanan sent for her and Tahanu, and Ged if he would come. But Ged wouldn't come, and Tahanu wouldn't come without her. That did frighten and worry her. Could her daughter not break free from her? It was Tahanu's counsel Labanan needed, not hers. But her daughter clung to her, as ill at ease, as out of place in the court of Havnor as the girl from Hur Atur was, and like her, silent, in hiding. So Tanar must play nursemaid, tutor and companion now to both of them, two scared girls who didn't know how to take hold of their power. Well, she wanted no power on earth except the freedom to go home where she belonged and help Ged with the garden. She wished they could grow white roses like these at home. Their scent was so sweet in the night air. But it was too windy on the Overfell, and the sun was too strong in summer. And probably the goats would eat the roses. She went back indoors at last and made her way through the eastern wing to the suite of rooms she shared with Tahanu. Her daughter was asleep, for it was late. A flame, no bigger than a pearl, burned on the wick of a tiny alabaster lamp. The high rooms were soft, shadowy. She blew out the lamp, got into bed, and soon sank toward sleep. She was walking along a narrow, high-vaulted corridor of stone. She carried the alabaster lamp. Its faint oval of light died away into darkness in front of her and behind her. She came to the door of a room that opened off the corridor. Inside the room were people with the wings of birds. Some had the heads of birds, hawks, and vultures. They stood or squatted motionless, not looking at her or at anything, with eyes encircled with white and red. Their wings were like huge black cloaks hanging down behind them. She knew they could not fly. They were so mournful, so hopeless, and the air in the room was so foul that she struggled to turn, to run away, but she could not move. And fighting that paralysis, she woke. There were the warm shadows, the stars in the window, the scent of roses, the soft stir of the city. Tahanu's breathing as she slept. Tanar sat up to shake off the remnants of the dream. It had been of the painted room in the labyrinth of the tombs, where she had first met Ged face to face 40 years ago. In the dream, the paintings on the walls had come to life, only it was not life. It was the endless, timeless unlife of those who died without rebirth. Those accursed by the nameless ones, infidels, westerners, sorcerers. After you died, you were reborn, That was the sure knowledge in which she had been brought up. When, as a child, she was taken to the tombs to be Arha, the Eaten One, they told her that she alone of all people had been and would be reborn as herself, life after life. Sometimes she had believed that, but not always, even when she was the priestess of the tombs, and never since. But she knew what all the people of the Kargad lands knew, that when they died, they would return in a new body. The lamp that guttered out, flickering up again that same instant elsewhere, in a woman's womb, or the tiny egg of a minnow, or a wind-borne seed of grass, coming back to be forgetful of the old life, fresh for the new, life after life, eternally. Only those outcast by the earth itself, by the old powers, the dark sorcerers of the Hardic lands, were not reborn. When they died, so said the Kargs, they did not rejoin the living world, but went to a dreary place of half-being where, winged but flightless, neither bird nor human, they must endure without hope. How the priestess Kossel had relished telling her about the terrible fate of those boastful enemies of the god-king, their souls doomed to be cast out of the world of light forever. But the afterlife Ged had told her of, where he said his people went, that changeless land of cold dust and shadow, was that any less dreary, any less terrible? Unanswerable questions clamored in her mind because she was no longer a Karg, because she had betrayed the sacred place. Must she go to that dry land when she died? Must Ged go there? Would they pass each other there uncaring? That was not possible. But what if he must go there, and she be reborn, so that their parting must be eternal? She would not think about all that. It was clear enough why she had dreamed of the painted room. All these years after she had left all that behind her. It had to do with seeing the ambassadors, speaking Kargish again, of course. But still she lay upset, unnerved by the dream. She did not want to go back to the nightmares of her youth. She wanted to be back in the house on the Overfell, lying by Ged, hearing Tehanu's breath while she slept. When he slept, Ged lay still as a stone, but the fire had left some damage in Tehanu's throat, so there was a little harshness always in her breathing. And Tanar had listened to that, listened for it, night after night, year after year. That was life. That was life returning, that dear sound, that slight, harsh breath. Listening to it, she slept again at last. If she dreamed, it was only of gulfs of air and the colors of morning moving in the sky.
Alder woke very early. His little companion had been restless all night, and so had he. He was glad to get up and go to the window and sit sleepily watching a light come into the sky over the harbor, fishing boats set out, and the sails of ships loom from a low mist in the great bay, and listening to the hum and bustle of the city making ready for the day. About the time he began to wonder if he should venture into the bewilderment of the palace to find what he was supposed to do, there was a knock on his door. A man brought in a tray of fresh fruit and bread, a jug of milk, and a small bowl of meat for the kitten. "I will come to conduct you to the king's presence when the fifth hour is tolled," he informed Alder solemnly, and then, rather less formally, told him how to get down into the palace gardens if he wanted to walk. Alder knew, of course, that there were 6 hours from midnight to noon, and 6 hours from noon to midnight, but he had never heard the hours told and wondered what the man meant. He learned presently that here in Havnor, 4 trumpeters went out on the high balcony from which rose the highest tower of the palace, the one that was topped with the slender steel blade of the hero's sword, and at the 4th and 5th hours before noon, and at noon, and at the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd hours after noon, they blew their trumpets. One to the west, one to the north, one to the east, one to the south. So the courtiers of the palace and the merchants and shippers of the city could arrange their doings and meet their appointments at the hour agreed. A boy he met walking in the gardens explained all this, a small, thin boy in a tunic that was too long for him. He explained that the trumpeters knew when to blow their trumpets because there were great sand clocks in the tower, as well as the pendulum of Ath, which hung down from high up in the tower and, if set swinging just at the hour, would cease to swing just as the next hour began. and he told Alder that the tunes the trumpeters played were all parts of the Lament for Aerith Akbi that King Meherrion wrote when he came back from Celador, a different one for each hour, but only at noon did they play the whole tune through. And if you wanted to be somewhere at a certain hour, you should keep an eye on the balconies, because the trumpeters always came out a few minutes early, and if the sun was shining, they held up their silver trumpets to flash and shine. The boy was called Rhodey, and he had come with his father, the Lord of Metema, on Ark, to stay a year in Havnor, and he went to school in the palace, and he was 9, and he missed his mother and his sister. Alder was back in his room in time to meet his guide, less nervous than he might have been. The conversation with the child had reminded him that the sons of lords were children, that lords were men, and that it was not men he need fear. His guide brought him through the palace corridors to a long, light room with windows all along one wall, looking out over Havnor's towers and fantastic bridges that arched over the canals and leapt from roof to roof and balcony to balcony across the streets. He half saw that panorama as he stood near the door, hesitant, not knowing if he should go forward to the group of people at the far end of the room. The king saw him and came to him, greeted him kindly, led him to the others, and introduced them one by one. There was a woman of 50 or so, small and very light-skinned, with graying hair and large gray eyes. Tanar, the king said, smiling, Tanar of the Ring. She looked Alder in the eye and greeted him quietly. There was a man of about the king's age, dressed in velvet and airy linens, with jewels on his belt and at his throat, and a great ruby stud in his earlobe. Shipmaster Tosla, said the king. Tosla's face, dark as old oak wood, was keen and hard. There was a middle-aged man, simply dressed, with a steady look that made Alder feel he could trust him. Prince Sege of the House of Havnor, said the king. There was a man of 40 or so who carried a wooden staff of his own height, by which Alder knew him as a wizard of the school on Roke. He had a rather worn face, fine hands, and aloof but courteous manner. Master Onyx, said the king. There was a woman whom Alder took for a servant because she was very plainly dressed and stayed outside the group, turned half away as if looking out the windows. He saw the beautiful fall of her black hair, heavy and glossy as falling water, as Labanon led her forward. Tehanu of Gaunt, the king said, and his voice rang out like a challenge. The woman looked straight at Alder for a moment. She was young. The left side of her face was smooth copper rose, a dark, bright eye under an arched eyebrow. The right side had been destroyed and was ridged, slabby scar, eyeless. Her right hand was like a raven's curled claw. She put out her hand to Alder in the manner of the people of Ea and the Enlades, as the others had done, but it was her left hand she held out. He touched his hand to hers, palm to palm. Hers was hot, fever hot. She looked at him again, an amazing glance from that one eye, bright, frowning, fierce. Then she looked down again and stood back as if she wished not to be one of them, wished not to be there. Master Alder bears a message for you from your father, the Hawk of Gaunt, the king said, seeing the messenger stand wordless. Tehanu did not lift her head. The glossy black hair almost hid the ruin of her face. My lady, Alder said, dry-mouthed and husky-voiced, he bade me ask you 2 questions. He paused, only because he had to wet his lips and get his breath in a moment of panic that he had forgotten what he was to say. But the pause became a waiting silence.
Tehanu said, in a voice hoarser than his, ask them.
He said to ask first, who are those who go to the dry land? And as I took my leave of him, he said, "Ask my daughter also, will a dragon cross the wall of stones?"
Tehanu nodded her head in acknowledgement and stepped back a little more, as if to carry her riddles away with her, away from them.
"The dry land," the king said, "and the dragons." His alert gaze went from face to face. "Come," he said, "let's sit and talk." "Perhaps we could talk down in the gardens," said the little gray-eyed woman, Tanar. The king agreed at once. Alder heard Tanar say to him as they went, "She finds it hard to be indoors all day. She wants the sky." Gardeners brought chairs for them in the shade of a huge old willow beside one of the pools. Tehanu went to stand by the pool, gazing down into the green water where a few big silver carp swam lazily. Clearly, she wanted to think over her father's message, not to talk, though she could hear what they said. When the others were all settled, the king had Alder tell his story yet again. Their silence as they listened was compassionate, and he was able to speak without constraint or hurry. When he was done, they remained silent a while, and then the wizard Onyx asked him one question. "Did you dream last night?" Alder said he had had no dream he could recall. "I did," Onyx said. "I dreamed of the summoner who was my teacher in the school on Roke. They say of him that he died twice, because he came back from that country across the wall. I dreamed of the spirits that are not reborn," Tanar said, very low. Prince Sege said, "All night I thought I heard voices down in the city streets, voices I knew from my childhood, calling as they used to do. But when I listened, it was only watchmen or drunken sailors shouting."
"I never dream," said Tosla. "I didn't dream of that country," the king said. "I remembered it, and couldn't cease remembering it."
He looked at the silent woman, Tehanu, but she only looked down into the pond and did not speak.
No one else spoke, and Alder could not stand it.
"If I am a plague-bringer, you must send me away," he said. The wizard Onyx spoke, not imperiously, but with finality.
"If Roke sent you to Gaunt, and Gaunt sent you to Havnor, Havnor is where you should be."
"Many heads make light thinking," said Tosla, sardonic. Labanon said, "Let's put dreams aside for a while. Our guest needs to know what we were concerned about before he came. Why I begged Tanar and Tehanu to come earlier this summer, and summoned Tosla from his voyaging to take counsel with us. Will you tell Alder of this matter, Tosla?"
The dark-faced man nodded. The ruby in his ear gleamed like a drop of blood.
"The matter is dragons," he said. "In the West Reach for some years now, they've come to farms and villages on Uli and Uzidero, flying low, seizing the roofs of houses with their talons, shaking them, terrifying the people. In the Torringates, they've come twice now at harvest time and set the fields burning with their breath, and burnt haystacks, and set the thatch of houses afire. They haven't struck at people, but people have died in the fires. They haven't attacked the houses of the lords of those islands, seeking after treasure the way they did in the dark years, but only the villages and the fields. The same word came from a merchantman who'd been southwest as far as Simli, trading for grain. Dragons had come and burnt the crop just as they were harvesting. Then, last winter in Semel, two dragons settled on the summit of the volcano, Mount Andandan."
"Ah," said Onyx, and at the king's inquiring glance, "the wizard Sepal of Palm tells me that mountain was a most sacred place to the dragons, where they came to drink fire from the earth in ancient days.
Well, they're back, said Tossla, and they come down harrying the herds and flocks that are the wealth of the people there, not hurting the beasts, but frightening them, so they break loose and run wild. The people say they're young dragons, black and thin, without much fire yet. And in Palm there are dragons living now in the mountains of the north part of the island, wild country without farms. Hunters used to go there to hunt mountain sheep and catch falcons to tame, but they've been driven out by the dragons, and no one goes near the mountains now. Maybe your Pelnish wizard knows about them.
Onyx nodded. He says flights of them have been seen above the mountains like the flights of wild geese. Between Palm and Semel and the island of Avnor is only the width of the Pelnish Sea, said Prince Sege. Alder was thinking that it was less than 100 miles from Semel to his own island town.
Tossla set out to the Dragon's Run in his ship, the Tern, the king said, but got barely in sight of the easternmost of those isles before a swarm of the beasts came at me, Tossla said with a hard grin. They harried me as they do the cattle and sheep, swooping down to singe my sails till I ran back where I came from. But that's nothing new.
Onyx nodded again.
Nobody but a dragon lord has ever sailed the Dragon's Run.
I have, the king said, and suddenly smiled a broad, boyish smile. But I was with the dragon lord. Now that's a time I've been thinking about. When I was in the West Reach with the Archmage, seeking Cobb the Necromancer, we passed Jessage, which lies even farther out than Simli, and we saw burned fields there. And in the Dragon's Run we saw that they fought and killed one another like animals gone rabid. After a time Prince Sege asked, could it be that some of those dragons did not recover from their madness in that evil time? It's been 15 years and more, Onyx said. But dragons live very long. Maybe time passes differently for them.
Alder noticed that as the wizard spoke, he glanced at Teanu, standing apart from them by the pool.
Yet only within the last year or two have they attacked people, said the prince.
That they have not, Tossla said. If a dragon wanted to destroy the people of a farm or village, who'd stop it? They've been after people's livelihood. Harvests, hayricks, farms, cattle. They're saying, begone, get out of the west.
But why are they saying it with fire, with havoc? The wizard demanded.
They can speak. They speak the language of the making. Morad and Aerith Ackby talked with dragons. Our Archmage talked with them.
Those we saw in the Dragon's Run, the king said, had lost the power of speech. The breach Cobb had made in the world was drawing their power from them, as it did from us. Only the great dragon Orm Embar came to us and spoke to the Archmage, telling him to go to Celador. He paused, his eyes far away. And even from Orm Embar, speech was taken before he died. Again, he looked away from them, a strange light in his face. It was for us Orm Embar died. He opened the way for us into the dark land. They were all silent for a while. Tenar's quiet voice broke the silence.
Once Sparrowhawk said to me, let me see if I can remember how he said it, that the dragon and the dragon's speech are one thing, one being, that a dragon does not learn the old speech, but is it.
As a tern is flight, as a fish is swimming, Onyx said slowly.
Yes.
Teanu was listening, standing motionless by the pool. They all looked at her now. The look on her mother's face was eager, urgent. Tehanu turned her head away. "How do you make a dragon talk to you?" the king said. He said it lightly, as if it were a pleasantry, but it was followed by another silence. "Well," he said, "that's something I hope we can learn. Now, Master Onyx, while we are speaking of dragons, will you tell us your story of the girl who came to the school on Roke? For none but me has heard it yet." "The girl in the school," said Tosla, with a scoffing grin. "Things have changed on Roke." "Indeed they have," the wizard said, with a long, cool look at the sailor. "This was some 8 years ago. She came from Wei, disguised as a young man, wanting to study the art magic. Of course, her poor disguise didn't fool the doorkeeper, yet he let her in, and he took her part. At that time, the school was headed by the master summoner. The man," and he hesitated a moment, "the man of whom I told you I dreamed last night." "Tell us something of that man, if you will, Master Onyx," the king said. "That was Thorion, who returned from death?" "Yes." "When the Archmage had been long gone and no word came, we feared he was dead. So the summoner used his arts to go see if indeed he had crossed the wall. He stayed long there, so the masters feared for him too. But at last he woke and said that the Archmage was there among the dead and would not return himself, but had bade Thorion return to govern Roke. Yet before long the dragon bore the Archmage Sparrowhawk living to us with my lord Labanon. Then, when the Archmage had departed again, the summoner fell down and lay as if life had gone out of him. The master herbal, with all his art, believed him dead. Yet, as we made ready to bury him, he moved and spoke, saying he had come back to life to do what must be done. So, since we were not able to choose a new archmage, Thorion the summoner governed the school." He paused. "When the girl came, though the doorkeeper had admitted her, Thorion would not have her within the walls. He would have nothing to do with her. But the master patterner took her to the grove, and she lived there some while at the edge of the trees, and walked with him among them. He and the doorkeeper and the herbal and Kudrum Karmeruk, the namer, believed that there was a reason she had come to Roke, that she was a messenger or an agent of some great event, even if she herself didn't know it. And so they protected her. The other masters followed Thorion, who said she brought only dissension and ruin and should be driven out. I was a student then. It was a sore trouble to us to know our masters, masterless, were quarreling. And over a girl," said Tosla. Onyx's look at him this time was extremely cold. "Quite," he said. After a minute, he took up his story. "To be brief, then, when Thorion sent a group of us to compel her to leave the island, she challenged him to meet her that evening on Roke Knoll. He came and summoned her by her name to obey him. Irion, he called her. But she said, 'I am not only Irion,' and speaking, she changed. She took the form of a dragon. She touched Thorion, and his body fell to dust. Then she climbed the hill, and watching her, we didn't know whether we saw a woman that burned like a fire or a winged beast. But at the summit we saw her clearly, a dragon like a flame of red and gold, and she lifted up her wings and flew into the west. His voice had grown soft, and his face was full of the remembered awe. Nobody spoke. The wizard cleared his throat. Before she went up the hill, the Namer asked her, "Who are you?" She said she did not know her other name. The patterner spoke to her, asking where she would go and whether she would come back. She said she was going beyond the west to learn her name from her own people, but if he called her, she would come. In the silence, a hoarse, weak voice, like metal brushing on metal, spoke. Alder did not understand the words, and yet they seemed familiar, as if he could almost remember what they meant. Tehanu had come close to the wizard and was standing by him, bending to him, tense as a drawn bow. It was she who had spoken. Startled and taken aback, the wizard stared up at her, got to his feet, backed off a step, and then, controlling himself, said, "Yes, those were her words. My people, beyond the west." "Call her. Oh, call her," Tehanu whispered, reaching out both her hands to him. Again, he drew back involuntarily. Tinar stood up and murmured to her daughter, "What is it? What is it, Tehanu?" Tehanu stared round at them all. Alder felt as if he were a wraith she saw through. "Call her here," she said. She looked at the king. "Can you call her?" "I have no such power. Perhaps the patterner of Roke. Perhaps you yourself." Tehanu shook her head violently. "No, no, no, no," she whispered. "I am not like her. I have no wings." Labanan looked at Tinar as if for guidance. Tinar looked miserably at her daughter. Tehanu turned around and faced the king. "I'm sorry," she said stiffly in her weak, harsh voice. "I have to be alone, sir. I will think about what my father said. I will try to answer what he asked. But I have to be alone. Please." Labanan bowed to her and glanced at Tinar, who went at once to her daughter and put an arm about her, and they went away on the sunny path by the pools and fountains. The four men sat down again and said nothing for a few minutes. Labanan said, "You were right, Onyx," and to the others, "Master Onyx told me this tale of the woman dragon Irion after I told him something about Tehanu. How as a child Tehanu summoned the dragon Kalesin to Gaunt and spoke with the dragon in the old speech, and Kalesin called her daughter." "Sire, this is very strange. This is a strange time when a dragon is a woman and when an untaught girl speaks in the language of the making." Onyx was deeply and obviously shaken, frightened. Alder saw that and wondered why he himself felt no such fear. Probably, he thought, because he did not know enough to be afraid, or what to be afraid of. "But there are old stories," Tossla said. "Haven't you heard them on Roke? Maybe your walls keep them out. They're only tales simple people tell. Songs, even. There's a sailor's song, the Lass of Belilo, that tells how a sailor left a pretty girl weeping in every port, until one of the pretty girls flew after his boat on wings of brass, and snatched him out of it and ate him." Onyx looked at Tossla with disgust, but Labanan smiled and said, "The woman of Kamai. The Archmage's old master, Ihal, called Ogion, told Tinar about her. She was an old village woman and lived as such. She invited Ogion into her cottage and served him fish soup. But she said mankind and dragonkind had once
been one. She herself was a dragon as well as a woman, and being a mage, Ogion saw her as a dragon, as you saw Irion, Onyx. Speaking stiffly and addressing himself to the king only, Onyx said, "After Irion left Roke, the master namer showed us passages in the most ancient lore books, which had always been obscure, but which could be understood to speak of beings both human and dragon, and of a quarrel or great division among them. But none of this is clear to our understanding." "I hoped that Tehanu might make it clear," Labanon said. His voice was even, so that Alder did not know whether he had given up or still held that hope. A man was hurrying down the path to them, a gray-headed soldier of the king's guards. Labanon looked round, stood up, went to him. They conferred for a minute, low-voiced. The soldier strode off again. The king turned back to his companions. "Here is news," he said, the ring of challenge in his voice again. "Over the west of Havnor there have been great flights of dragons. They have set forests afire, and a coaster's crew say people fleeing down to Southport told them the town of Rezbel is burning."
That night, the king's swiftest ship carried him and his party across the Bay of Havnor, running fast before the mage wind Onyx raised. They came into the mouth of the Onava River, under the shoulder of Mount On, at daybreak. With them 11 horses were disembarked, fine, strong, slender-legged creatures from the royal stables. Horses were rare on all the islands but Havnor and Semel. Tehanu knew donkeys well enough, but had never seen a horse before. She had spent much of the night with them and their handlers, helping control and calm them. They were well-bred, mannerly horses, but not used to sea voyages. When it came time to mount them, there on the sands of the Onava, Onyx was fairly daunted and had to be coached and encouraged by the handlers, but Tehanu was up in the saddle as soon as the king. She put the reins in her crippled hand and did not use them, seeming to communicate with her mare by other means. So the little caravan set off due west into the foothills of the Falliarns, keeping up a good pace. It was the swiftest way to travel that Labanon had at his disposal. To coast clear round South Havnor would take too long. They had the wizard Onyx with them to keep the weather favorable, clear the path of any obstacles, and defend them from any harm short of dragonfire. Against the dragons, if they encountered them, they had no defense at all, except perhaps Tehanu.
Taking counsel the evening before with his advisers and the officers of his guard, Labanon had quickly concluded that there was no way to fight the dragons or protect the towns and fields from them. Arrows were useless, shields were useless. Only the greatest mages had ever been able to defeat a dragon. He had no such mage in his service, and knew of none now living, but he must defend his people as best he could, and he knew no way to do it but to try to parley with the dragons. His majordomo had been shocked when he set off for the apartment where Tanar and Tehanu were. The king should send for those he wished to see, command them to come to him. "Not if he's going to beg from them," Labanon said. He told the startled maid who answered their door to ask if he might speak with the White Lady and the Woman of Gaunt. So they were known to the people of the palace and the city. That each bore her true name openly, as the king did, was so rare a matter, so defiant of rule and custom, of safety and propriety, that though people might know the name, they were reluctant to say it and preferred to speak around it. He was admitted, and having told them briefly the news he had received, he said, "Tehanu, it may be that you alone in my kingdom can help me. If you can call to these dragons as you call to Kalesin, if you have any power over them, if you can speak to them and ask why they war on my people, will you do so?" The young woman shrank from his words, turning towards her mother. But Tanar did not offer her any shelter. She stood unmoving. After a while she said, "Tehanu, long ago I told you,
When a king speaks to you, you answer. You were a child then and didn't answer. You're not a child now. Tahanu took a step back from them both. Like a child, she hung her head. I can't call to them, she said in her faint, harsh voice. I don't know them. Can you call Kalesin? Labanan asked. She shook her head. Too far away, she whispered. I don't know where. But you are Kalesin's daughter, Tanar said. Can you not speak to these dragons? She said wretchedly, I don't know. Labanan said, if there is any chance, Tahanu, that they'll talk to you, that you can talk to them, I beg you to take that chance. For I can't fight them and don't know their language, and how can I find what they want of us from creatures who can destroy me with a breath, with a look? Will you speak for me? For us? She was silent. Then, so faintly he could barely hear it, she said, Yes. Then make ready to travel with me. We leave by the fourth hour of the evening. My people will bring you to the ship. I thank you. And I thank you, Tanar, he said, taking her hand a moment, but no longer, for he had much to see to before he went. When he came down to the wharf, late and hurrying, there was the slender hooded figure. The last horse to be led aboard was snorting and bracing its feet, refusing to go up the gangplank. Tahanu seemed to be conferring with the handler. Presently she took the horse's bridle and talked to it a little, and they went up the gangplank, quietly together. Ships are small, crowded houses. Labanan heard two of the hostlers talking softly on the afterdeck towards midnight. She has the true hand, one said, and the other, a younger voice. Aye, she does, but she's horrible to look at, ain't she? The first one said, If a horse don't mind it, why should you? And the other, I don't know, but I do. Now as they rode from the Onava sands into the foothills, where the way widened, Tosla brought his horse up beside Babanan's. She's to be our interpreter, is she? He asked. If she can. Well, she's braver than I'd have thought. That happened to her the first time she talked with a dragon. It's likely to happen again. What do you mean? And she was half burned to death. Not by a dragon. Who, then? The people she was born to. How was that? Tosla asked with a grimace. Tramps, thieves. She was 5 or 6 years old. Whatever she did or they did, it ended in her being beaten unconscious and shoved into their campfire. Thinking, I suppose, she was dead or would die and it would be taken for an accident, they made off. Villagers found her, and Tanar took her in. Tosla scratched his ear. There's a pretty tale of human kindness. So she's no daughter of the old archmage, either. But then what do they mean saying she's a dragon's get? Labanan had sailed with Tosla, had fought beside him years ago in the siege of Sora, and knew him a brave, keen, cool-headed man. When Tosla's coarseness chafed him, he blamed his own thin skin. I don't know what they mean, he answered mildly. All I know is the dragon called her daughter. That roque wizard of yours, that Onyx, is quick to say he's no use in this matter, but he can speak the old tongue, can't he? Yes, he could wither you into ash with a few words of it. If he hasn't, it's out of respect for me, not you, I think. Tosla nodded. I know that, he said. They rode all that day at as quick a pace as the horses could keep, coming at nightfall to a little hill town where the horses could be fed and rested, and the riders could sleep in variously uncomfortable beds. Those of them unused to riding now discovered they could barely walk. The people there had heard nothing about dragons, and were overwhelmed only by the terror and glory of a whole party of rich strangers riding in and wanting oats and beds and paying for them with silver and gold. The riders set off again long before dawn. It was nearly 100 miles from the sands of Onava to Resbel. This second day would take them over the low pass of the Faliern Mountains and down the western side. Yanai, one of Labanan's most trusted officers, rode well ahead of the others. Tosla was rear guard. Labanan led the main group. He was jogging along half asleep in the dull quiet before dawn when hoofbeats coming towards him woke him. Yanai had come riding back. Labanan looked up where the man was pointing. They had just emerged from the woods on the crest of an open hillside
and could see through the clear half-light all the way to the pass. The mountains to either side of it massed black against the dull reddish glow of a cloudy dawn. But they were looking west. "That's nearer than Resbel," Unite said. 15 miles, maybe." Tahanu's mare, though small, was the finest of the lot, and had a strong conviction that she should lead the others. If Tahanu didn't hold her back, she would keep sidling and overtaking till she was ahead of the line. The mare came up at once when Labanan reined in his big horse, and so Tahanu was beside him now, looking where he looked. "The forest is burning," he said to her. He could see only the scarred side of her face, so she seemed to gaze blindly. But she saw, and her claw hand that held the reins was trembling. "The burned child fears the fire," he thought. What cruel, cowardly folly had possessed him to tell this girl, "Come talk to the dragon, save my skin, and bring her straight into the fire." "We will turn back," he said. Tahanu raised her good hand, pointing. "Look," she said. "Look." A spark from a bonfire, a burning cinder rising over the black line of the pass, an eagle of flame soaring, a dragon flying straight at them. Tahanu stood up in her stirrups and let out a piercing, scraping cry like a seabird's or a hawk's scream. But it was a word, one word. "Medeu!" The great creature drew nearer with terrible speed, its long, thin wings beating almost lazily. It had lost the reflection of fire and looked black or bronze-colored in the growing light. "Mind your horses," Tahanu said in her cracked voice. And just then, Labanan's gray gelding saw the dragon and started violently, tossing its head and backing. He could control it, but behind him, one of the other horses let out a neigh of terror, and he heard them trampling and the handlers' voices. The wizard Onyx came running up and stood beside Labanan's horse. Mounted or afoot, they stood and watched the dragon come. Again, Tahanu cried out that word. The dragon veered in its flight and slowed, came on, stopped, and hovered in the air about 50 feet from them. "Medeu!" Tahanu called, and the answer came like an echo prolonged. "Medeu!" "What does it mean?" Labanan asked, bending to Onyx.
"Sister, brother,"
the wizard whispered. Tahanu was off her horse and had tossed the reins to Unai, was walking forward down the slight slope to where the dragon hovered, its long wings beating quick and short like a hovering hawk's. But these wings were 50 feet from tip to tip, and as they beat they made a sound like kettle drums or rattles of brass. As she came closer to it, a little curl of fire escaped from the dragon's long, long-toothed open mouth. She held up her hand, not the slender brown hand, but the burned one, the claw. The scarring of her arm and shoulder kept her from raising it fully. She could reach barely as high as her head. The dragon sank a little in the air, lowered its head, and touched her hand with its lean, flared, scaled snout. Like a dog, an animal greeting and sniffing, Labanan thought. Like a falcon stooping to the wrist. Like a king bowing to a queen. Tahanu spoke. The dragon spoke. Both briefly. In their cymbal shiver voices. Another exchange, a pause. The dragon spoke at length. Onyx listened intently. One more exchange of words. A wisp of smoke from the dragon's nostrils. A stiff, imperious gesture of the woman's crippled, withered hand. He spoke clearly two words. "Bring her," the wizard translated in a whisper. The dragon beat its wings hard, lowered its long head and hissed, spoke again, then sprang up into the air high over Tahanu, turned, wheeled once, and set off like an arrow to the west.
"It called her Daughter of the Eldest," the wizard whispered, as Tahanu stood motionless, watching the dragon go.
He turned around, looking small and fragile in that great sweep of hill and forest, in the gray dawn light. Labanan swung off his horse and hurried forward to her. He thought to find her drained and terrified. He put out his hand to help her walk. But she smiled at him. Her face, half terrible, half beautiful, shone with the red light of the unrisen sun.
They won't strike again. They will wait in the mountains, he said. Then indeed she looked around as if she did not know where she was, and when Labanon took her arm, she let him do so. But the fire and the smile lingered in her face, and she walked lightly. While the hostlers held the horses, already grazing on the dew-wet grass, Onyx, Tosla, and Yanai came round her, though they kept a respectful distance. Onyx said, My lady, Tanu, I have never seen so brave an act.
Nor I, Tosla said.
I was afraid, Tahanu said in her voice that carried no emotion. But I called him brother, and he called me sister. I could not understand all you said, the wizard said. I have no such knowledge of the old speech as you. Will you tell us what passed between you? She spoke slowly, her eyes on the west where the dragon had flown. The dull red of the distant fire was paling as the east grew bright. I said, Why are you burning the king's island? And he said, It is time we have our own lands again. And I said, Did the eldest bid you take them with fire? Then he said that the eldest, Kalesin, had gone with Orm Irion beyond the west to fly on the other wind. And he said, The young dragons who remained here, on the winds of the world, say men are oath-breakers who stole the dragon's lands. They tell one another that Kalesin will never return, and they will wait no longer, but will drive men out of all the western lands. But lately Orm Irion has returned and is on Pollen, he said. And I told him to ask her to come, and he said she would come to Kalesin's daughter.